I obviously have been visiting a lot over the last few years, and I intend to visit a lot. So I would like to extend this invitation to come and visit me, and I want to keep growing collaboration and science meetings between not only CETA, where I know there's a strong interest already, but also the Dunlop Institute, where I'm based, and the University of Toronto in general. It's really fun. And I thought, given that I've come, I've visited many times, and I've actually given quite a few science talks over the last couple of years, so to make sure that you're not completely bored of hearing about me and or axions and or at the power spectrum of the CMB, I thought I'd just highlight some other bits of research that we're doing from the Atacama, because there are some really interesting results, and we're pushing forward. I'll show some slides at the end that are so hot off the press that, you know, we're actually not going to broadcast this talk straight away, because we're hard at work, and I hope you'll get excited. And also, I wanted to highlight, we have a lot of amazing... Ooh, I just ended my talk. Well, that was it. Thanks, guys. I think that's the laser pointer. Okay, yeah. No, okay. Turns out the laser pointer doesn't work. So that's fine. No, I don't need it. I can just wave my hands around. It's fine. Oh, yeah, I'm not Canadian enough for that yet. Also, I'm taking requests. If anyone can teach me how to skate backwards, like, well, I'm going to be here for the next 5 years. I would really like to learn how to do that. I'm from Africa, and ice skating was not something I did growing up. But I wanted to highlight just some of the, you know, we have a lot of great experimentalists working on ACT and ACPOL, and they're doing really amazing things that enable us to do our science going forward. So this is the Atacama Cosmology Telescope with some beautiful stars in the background, and you'll see another version of this. So I was at CMB at 50 in the middle of last year, and I was really amazed as someone who is a post-WMAP baby. I started my research career after WMAP. It's very easy to forget that we have this incredible history. Hi, guys. And so I thought I'd show a couple of slides that my colleagues put up that really just reminded me of how much work has gone into getting these amazing measurements of the cosmic microwave background. And also, this is to highlight, you know, we're very, COBE is wonderful and deserving, but there were other measurements, even of the black body spectrum, that deserve to be noted and appreciated. But of course, the name of the game, once we'd measured the overall temperature, became measuring the anisotropies. And these slides from Lyman Page really show this development. So we started in 1965, and you see, like, the measurements are kind of all over the place with no real limits, but they then provided the theoretical priors going forward. As we moved on, so the gray bands are now giving you theoretical priors on what we think the power would be. And interesting, when Lyman first put these slides up, he said, talk about a potential experimental bias. If people had focused on the L of 200 region, they would have, you know, detected something kind of sooner. But it was good that people were measuring all over the multiple range. Moving forward. Right. Right. I think, you know, that I think that that's, you know, it's good to have, I think, these kinds of things. But when I listen to a lot of these talks, you realize that there was a lot of infighting and kind of pushing around, which just gets erased by history, which is why I like to show these. The beginning of the 90s, you know, you kind of things start to pick up a little bit on large scales. With, of course, the COBE DMR in 92. And, you know, initially they basically were just, can we fit like an amplitude and a power spectrum, scalar spectral index? But still all over the map, really. And then things progressed. So this is 94 to 96. And you start to see, okay, we're doing pretty well on larger scales. And maybe you see a rise in the data points, although it looks like that first peak, you know, again, the error bars were big, but it was uncertain. And then, so here we go towards the end of the century, the first peak. Now the constraints are starting to get better. And it's interesting, if we go back to, of course, this plot, if you then see, as soon as the peak starts to get interesting, a lot of those observations now are kind of focused. So it's interesting to see how we move experimentally also to look for where we think the gold might be. Then in 2000, now you start to see experiments like Boomerang and Maximus really probing, you know, the blue points that you can see there are starting to probe that rise, and also the dip that really was giving us really that evidence for the peak rather than just something that was rising and then being constant. 2001 to 2002, now the peaks are starting to be fleshed out a little bit more, although, you know, if you didn't have the guiding line of the power spectrum, you might say, well, some of those are consistent with just flat rather than a higher order peak structure. And then this is now just before WMAP made their release of their results with, again, the theoretical priors. And things are starting to get fleshed out even without WMAP, which is, again, just good to remind ourselves. And then this is the last plot in the series, which is the WMAP first-year results with all of the rest combined into those gray boxes as priors, which is pretty neat. This would be impressive enough, but of course, the CMB has come on a long way since then. And I still like to show this plot, even though now it's outdated, but I think it's artistically, it's the most attractive of the Planck plots, also made by a friend and collaborator of mine, Erminia Calabrese. But you can see the real exquisite measurement of the power spectrum of the CMB. This comes now as no surprise. And it just shows you how far we've come, both on the theoretical side in terms of modeling, but also really on the observational side that we've made these incredible measurements. And so moving in that vein, in the Atacama Cosmology Telescope, we're looking at on small scales. And I just wanted to highlight this incredible image. If you pay a little bit of attention to making beautiful pictures of your experiment, it looks great. So this is John Ward, who was observing and thought he would take a photo of the Milky Way. So ACT is 5,200 meters above sea level in the deserts of northern Chile. We typically have an average precipitable water vapor of about half a millimeter, which means that the site is very dry. Although at the moment, even though El Nino is great for California, it's not so great for the Atacama. And so this is our typical snow season. So we've just stopped observing and we'll stop observing for a couple of months and then start again once the weather kind of dries up again. But here you see the small scale experiments on the same kind of theory curve as Planck data. Now this is, you normally see CMB plots with foregrounds, where you see the foregrounds rising as a function of, as you go to smaller angular scales. And here they've been marginalized out. So one way to do this is rather, when you're fitting your model, rather than fitting a 6 or 7 or 8 parameter cosmological model and foregrounds, you can just say, let me estimate the CMB power plus the foregrounds. And so really then, if you then take those data points, you can just throw any theoretical model at it without worrying about the foregrounds. And here you see that really the small scales both complement and really extend measurements from experiments like Planck out to smaller scales and are helping us constrain a lot of the non-standard physical models rather than just the 6 or 7 simple parameterizations. So what constraints do we have from the temperature maps? Obviously, so what I'm not going to focus on in this talk is a lot of the cosmology results that you've seen before. We have constraints on...
Can you go back?
And
ACT and ACT and Planck.
Yeah.
Is this in which paper is this?
So this is in the likelihood paper.
Okay.
Yeah. So this is the CMB, and it's actually this likelihood is out as well. So this is work led by Erminia, where you then, because you're marginalizing over the foregrounds, with your CMB CLs as the data product, it means you can just take these data points and fit your cosmology without doing the full run. So it's called Plick Light if you're looking for the likelihood. You need to worry over here. Worry that you can trust the error bars, because when the CMB is effectively going to zero, then estimating it, you know, you start to get biased. But
Lowells and Highnells, or the
lights? It's incorporating everything together to do the marginalization. Okay, so rather than look at the cosmology, let's see some of the other interesting things that are coming. That are cosmological in origin, but aren't necessarily just constraints to extensions of Lambda CDM. So I think one of the biggest results that's come out of Planck is, of course, this measurement of the lensing potential. So at the top, what you see is a Wiener-filtered the reconstruction of the deflection field. And it was noted at the time of the release that this has roughly the same signal to noise as the original COBE map. So that's interesting that we've started the generation of improving the constraints on lensing in the same way that we have with primordial CMB. But there are other groups also looking at lensing using a variety of sources. So I'll discuss ours, but this rather interesting plot is from the SPT groups, and it shows a combination of a smeared galaxy overdensity map with the lensing reconstruction in contours. And so what you can do is you can actually cross-correlate your lensing observable with other traces, such as galaxies and quasars and clusters, to try and see how structure is doing the lensing if you focus on a particular group. And I'll discuss that in a little bit more detail. What does the power spectrum of this deflection field look? So this is a four-point function because you are reconstructing. You basically use a two-point function to reconstruct the lensing. And so in together, you have a four-point function of the temperature in this power spectrum. And really, the reason why lensing is interesting is because it combines both growth information because of the clustering of large-scale structure, but also tells you something about the geometry, particularly if you combine it with other probes as well, because you can sort of start to see how structure is changing along the line of sight. This is a fantastic spectrum and shows the previous ACT measurements and the SPT measurements of the deflection power, as well as the Planck data. But I think it's, again, worth highlighting, because people use PR plots, that if you actually are using the data from Planck to constrain any of your models, the likelihood is restricted to be only in the range enclosed by the box here. That's partly because they want to be conservative. There are systematic issues on smaller scales. But it's interesting to see that if we were using the whole lensing deflection, you would have even more constraining power. And so this will grow and become better as the data improves and the analysis techniques improve as well. But it's already pretty exciting. So the Planck constraints put limits on the lensing neutrino mass. Constraints are really interesting. So here you have the sum of the neutrino masses constrained to less than 0.7 EV. That's if you'd only include Planck data plus lensing. You can then add other probes. So if you have, basically what the neutrinos are doing is they're damping out your structure, so they're changing the effect of lensing. You have to understand that that's a little bit compensated for in terms of your matter density as well, because that will contribute totally to omega CH squared, omega MH, dark matter H squared. So there are a couple of competing effects, but we are really only sensitive to the sum of the neutrino masses. And if you add other probes like constraints from the BAO, you can then constrain that further because you get independent probes on the degeneracies. So for example, between omega CH squared and the neutrino mass. So it's good to have independent checks, of course, and this is work led by Alex van Engelen, who's now at CEDA, but was at Stony Brook. And this is using our ACT maps on small scales to do the same kind of reconstruction as the Planck team and to constrain the power spectrum in the same way. So here, the points that were included were the 2013 lensing rather than the 2015. And the blue points are showing our error bars. Now, again, these look like big points, but they're really telling you something about the overall amplitude. And this is one of the things that I think was the most interesting to come out of the Planck results, is that there still seems to be a little bit of a tension. If you say, how much lensing do I expect to be from the smearing of the peaks? Because lensing is shifting power around, and so it generates smearing of power, and so basically the troughs become flatter and the peaks become, less deep and the peaks become flatter as well. And so I can measure just an amplitude of lensing, say A lensing. If I compare that number to the number that I get from the deflection reconstruction, they're different. They're significantly different by about 2 sigma. Yeah, about 2 sigma significance, which, is either completely insignificant or, compatible. But there's an interesting, the data should really be, these are not different data sets. It's the same. They're different systematics, but it's the same information. Essentially, it's the same information. So that's interesting. And so having independent checks, both of the temperature number, but also of the deflection number, will just help to shore up this measurement. But it's quite neat. It's interesting as a check, particularly because there are things that can smear power around from the temperature, like beam issues. But whether or not they'll actually generate such an AL is not always clear. So I mentioned that rather than just reconstruct the lensing on its own, and look at the power spectrum, which is interesting. You can also say, well, can I look for cross-correlations between that lensing signal and other probes? And so this, for example, is what we did with, led by a student out of Oxford, Rupert Allison, and he was interested in saying, well, can we cross-correlate the lensing maps with a density map from radio sources? So he looked for first sources from the first radio catalog and preferentially selected the AGN sample from this catalog. So here you see the top panel is the lensing reconstruction field, and then the bottom panel is the kind of smoothed density of first sources. And then he computed the spatial cross-correlation between them. Now, of course, there you really do need them to be spatially correlated because you're looking in the same map, statistically speaking, are the overdensities giving me lensing? And this is what the correlation looks like between the two. So the lensing reconstruction was performed with both ACT and ACPOL data. And you see again, woohoo, we have 4.4 sigma over null, which is significant. And the error bars will increase as the both the survey overlap increases. So this is one of the reasons why we're pushing to large survey overlap, but also if how the error is increasing. Now, one of the checks to see if we know what we're doing is to check on simulations. And our simulations do a little bit better, but we can see that things are consistent here with the results. Now, this is also interesting not only because it's the, oh, we said, great, we can see a cross-correlation between galaxies and lensing, but we can also look at different surveys that are sensitive to different redshifts and say, what does that tell me about the bias of the traces? Because we know that all traces of the underlying dark matter density are going to be biased, and that bias will maybe change with redshift. But it's not always known exactly how that change, you know, what the functional form is, and so we can use comparisons of different surveys to try and measure this. So this is one of the things that Rupert did. So this is a rough B of Z plot where the functional form of the bias as a function of redshift is really coming into your weighting in the total cross-correlation power spectrum. Depending on how you cut up your sample, you can get sources that are have an effective redshift of either slightly lower than one or slightly higher than one, and just measure the overall amplitude. And if you're lucky, maybe you see a little bit of a functional form with redshift. But these are early days. And so really what the main point of the paper was to constrain the bias at an effective redshift of about 1.5 of these AGN sources, and we get around 3.5 plus or minus 0.8. And this agrees pretty well with work that's done by some of our collaborators in the South. So the folks at SPT Poll did something similar. I like this image. So again, here they're using WISE, the WISE catalog, and focusing on quasar selected sources. And here they see, they basically stack patches where they center the stacking patch on the position of the WISE quasars. And they see for overdensities and underdensities relative to the mean, they see a significant decrement or increment in the deflection, reconstructed deflection maps, which again is kind of cool. The solid contours are giving you, I think they're one sigma contours on the reconstruction.
What is that B up there?
So this is the bias that they infer for this population. The using basically similar techniques.
Why is that different from that bias?
So the redshift is a little bit different. So I've shown here, if we take our, so theirs is at a redshift of one, ours is at a redshift of 1.5. And if we do the conversion, we basically find if we take our bias number and bring it down to redshift of 1, we get 2.6 plus or minus 0.6. They get 1.6 plus or minus 0.2. So, you know, not completely inconsistent.
Is that quasar sources or absorption spectrum from lambda and alpha?
Quasar sources. Yeah. Okay. So now you can say, well, this is probing a certain mass range. Let's look at a different mass range because, of course, we're interested in what is the lensing signal from different traces. And so Matthew Matevecherel, who is finishing up his PhD, did this really neat work as well, saying, okay, can now we take a stacking analysis based on galaxies from the CMAS survey and stack, again, our lensing deflection reconstruction around the positions. And here What he also did, which is quite nice, is say, well, can we take our best fitting NFW profile and fit it to these data points? And what do we get for the central mass and the concentration, which you see in the dashed line? And it's quite neat to see if you then take random positions and stack our deflection that you don't see the same effect. You really are seeing an overdensity at around the, you know, 3 sigma from the lensing of these sort of 10 to the 13 solar mass halos, galaxies. So again, probing a different mass scale. So these kinds of cross-correlation analyses, I think, will grow. And in particular, as we get data from different sources and we expand the sky area that we overlap with, we'll start to really be able to probe how are these traces changing in their astrophysics, so in their bias, for example, and how is our lensing responding? You know, how do our lensing maps really show that the lensing of the CMB is responding to these over densities and under densities as well in the future? So another area in which we're growing and we're very interested in is really not just the primordial CMB, although whatever that word doesn't necessarily mean anything, but these secondary sources, one of which is, of course, the Sunyaev-Zeldovich effect.
When it's contrasted by the previous plot, on the left-hand side, the best fit model was under all of the data points. Why should that be correlated the data points on the set?
Well, Right, especially on that gradient, yeah. But I mean, I think that's a fair point. I mean, I guess one of the things when you, if you think of the chi-squared, that's where, in a sense, being over or under it doesn't really make a difference. So that's interesting that it goes under all of them.
And it's a little trivial when you get better
fit. Right, although this gradient is so deep. Yeah, that is really interesting. So the model is from an kind of independent lensing collaboration with another collaborator, but it's something worth looking at. I mean,
The thing, you don't actually see the off-diagonal part of the covariance.
That's true.
It's very typical when you look at correlation points in the real space that you miss. I mean, you're either above all the points or below the point.
That's, I guess, the problem with averaging over a two-dimensional plot like this. Oh, there's also something to be taken into account, which I didn't really mention before, is that there's a slight miscentering. If you see the center of the lensing is not necessarily in the center of the plot, that is understood and is kind of within the fact that there's an uncertainty within Y's as well of the position of the central position of these sources. So, but that shouldn't necessarily be affecting the model that you fit. But maybe it's worth including that as a parameter, the miscentering offset. I'm sure no one in the room is a stranger to the SZ effect. And I can say Z again, it's great to be back. But of course, while we have really been focusing in the past on the thermal SZ effect, which is really how the CMB photons get boosted by the hot electron gas in a cluster, and that gives you the biggest frequency-dependent effect that you see in this solid white line in this figure from Karlstrom, where the top is just showing you the CMB intensity as a function of frequency. The kinetic SZ is smaller, so this is the dashed line, but also potentially really interesting because it's sensitive to the electron momentum, and so it's going to tell us different things at different regimes, which is good. One of the things that we do is we measure clusters depending on their signal. Because of the thermal SZ effect, we can see clusters, because we have different frequencies in CMB maps, we can see clusters that aren't necessarily found first with optical catalogs. And we can measure, using this effect and the fact that you're integrating the electron density over the line of sight, you can actually measure a cluster mass associated with this SZ signal. But one of the biggest different sort of issues in using these clusters for cosmology is the fact that we want to make sure that our masses are calibrated. And so I'll discuss this in a little bit more detail, but when people talk about a tension between the SZ cluster results and the CMB results, they're often talking around this issue, that there's sometimes we worry about the systematic calibration of the masses. And so this was work led by Nick Battaglia, who's at Princeton, but basically we used weak lensing measurements of the clusters based on measurements from the CFHT lens survey to provide an independent mass measurement of the clusters. So a combination of simulations and these weak lensing measurements allowed us to get masses for the clusters, which is great. And what we found that we had a particular combination of clusters that were detected both in ACT and in Planck. And we found something interesting. When we take the SZ measurement, first of all, from Planck, and we take the SZ mass measurement from ACT, we found that they didn't match. They didn't match on a one-to-one relationship. And this was interesting, it was and kind of strange, because of course, if ours don't match theirs, then of course the any calibration that we apply will be a little bit different too.
So do you use the same scaling
relation,
or do you get
mass
from a set
plot? Right, so the relations are the same, but the difference actually is that there's a correction that wasn't made for Eddington bias. So basically, Eddington bias is just a statistical bias that basically means if you have a slope of your mass function, then you're preferentially scattering error bars in one direction. Even if you have an equal area bar, error bar, if you imagine just one sigma scatter, if you have a very steep function, you're more preferentially going to scatter up than down. Did I get that right? So Planck is up, yeah, up than down. So you're going to bias your mass measurements high. Once we corrected for this, you'll have to take my word for it. But once we actually include this calibration, we're on a one-to-one line with the Planck results. So we show in this paper that something as simple as correcting for the Eddington bias actually can change your reconstruction or your estimate of the SZ masses. And this goes some way to resolving some of this tension. So,
why is this in one of them and not the other one? So
we're using the SZ masses that are just published by Planck,
uh-huh.
And then we're estimating the SZ masses ourselves.
Okay, and then which one is the one that has a bias?
So they both have a bias because they both suffer from Eddington bias, but we allow for the bias, whereas Planck doesn't include that bias. So if you then include an extra factor for the bias, you can change the Planck point so that we agree. Now, that's only kind of only important if you take the Planck clusters from a catalog. The Planck team, when they're doing their cosmology, they can include parameters to kind of soak up that bias. But if you just take the masses, you've got to be careful for this kind of bias. Otherwise, when you're doing your survey independently and you're cross-correlating with Planck or you're combining with Planck, you will be affected by this bias. Right. There's a tension between different estimates of this 1 minus B number, which is basically the ratio. Sorry, I'm jumping around a little bit. The ratio of SZ. So now we show that there's a difference between the SZ masses from Planck and ACT. But now you want to say, let me calibrate that to weak lensing, okay? Which we're going to just parameterize by the number 1 minus B. So basically this, how different is the mass that you get from gas compared to the overall weak lensing, which is just sensitive maybe to the potential. And so what we find, I'll go back now here, that this changes depending on your sample. So here is the same parameter estimated within Planck, and you see you get very different numbers for this bias, difference between SZ and weak lensing, depending on what sample you use. And this has been discussed, many people have been discussing how the CMB will give you different constraints in this omega matter sigma 8 plane compared to if you use clusters alone or if you use the CMB. What we found is that this calibration goes some way towards resolving this. So if we use our weak lensing calibrations, okay, the error bars are reasonably large, but if you include this error bar, then the tension between the value you infer from the CMB, which is this gray band, And the value that you infer from other experiments. So the green and the purple are completely independent analyses. Really, what we're showing is if you include the biases correctly and your Eddington calibrations, you can correct for some of the tension between CMB and cluster physics, which is good because ideally we want to understand what the differences are before people start proposing that there's some fundamentally different way SZ or gas and dark matter behave and kind of inventing new particles or whatever. We really want to understand, do we know the systematics of our experiments well enough? And if there are corrections that reduce this tension, that's valid. And so this rather complicated plot shows you this. You can get rid of a lot of the tension just by including a roughly 16% error between the two. So again, this is a work by Nick Battaglia, which came out just towards the end of last year. Okay. Another cross-correlation that we looked for is saying, can we actually now do a kind of similar analysis to the using quasars that the SPT folks did with lensing, but now we're actually saying, let's just use multi-frequency data, so data from ACT and Herschel, which is sensitive to different components, mainly the dust, around our quasar positions that we've detected. So we detect quasars in an optical survey like Sloan Digital Sky Survey, and then we make a measurement of those quasars with ACT and compare that to Herschel. And one of the things that you want to take away from this plot, this is as a function of many different redshifts, okay? But one of the things to take away from it is that the best fitting spectral energy distribution model, which really is telling you about all the energy of the photons around this quasar, is best fit if you allow for not only dust, which we know will be there, but really includes a thermal SZ component, which is great because we've previously looked at either just the integrated thermal SZ effect or the thermal SZ around stacking on galaxies. And now, even if we look at quasars, it makes the most sense in our astrophysical picture of these objects if we include a thermal SZ effect, or the it's sort of energy coming from the thermal SZ. And this is sort of consistent as a function of redshift, which is good. Moving a little bit from the thermal SZ to the kinetic SZ, I know that people are really interested in this here. We want to try, I think the next phase of CMB cosmology is really unpacking this kinetic SZ effect. So the difference between the thermal and the kinetic SZ is just the extra boost that you get from the fact, if we're talking about a galaxy, from the fact that the galaxy cluster is moving, you get that additional boost. But really it's sensitive to the electron momentum field anywhere. And so depending on how you unravel this effect, you can actually find the kinetic SZ associated with different sources. So for example, if you take pairs of galaxies and you stack them, you look for the effect between them, momentum pairs, you're looking at how are galaxies falling into a potential. And that's one approach that we did with an undergrad at Princeton, which is measure the decrement associated with pairs of galaxies along the line of sight that are going to be preferentially falling into a potential and measure this pairwise momentum, which will tell you about the KSZ effect. And that's a local, really looking at local overdensities that these galaxies are moving into. But you can also look more broadly if you say, well, actually, let me use the density of galaxies from a survey like BAST and reconstruct the velocity just using the fact that we have, the linearized continuity equation. You can measure. Okay. They're like, you're done. This is it. Oh, thanks, guys. Great. But there are also other techniques. And so one of the techniques that I know that a lot of people here have been pushing and a grad student at Princeton, Manuel Shan, has been working on is really measuring the difference in temperature, the KSZ effect associated with just this reconstructed velocity. So now we're not talking about finding pairs of galaxies and measuring their pairwise momentum. We're looking at an overall density field reconstructing the velocity that would be associated with that density field, and then measuring and searching for the KZ effect associated with that. And so this is from Sean et al. 2015, which is using CMAS galaxies, so again, optical BOSS data, and estimating as a function of your kind of aperture. If you have a patch, you want to measure how this KZ effect is happening. And we do this in a very simple way, using a parameter alpha, where the biggest uncertainty really is coming in our reconstruction of the, or our understanding of the optical depth at any of these points. Again, it's a neat result. It's a first result of around 3 sigma, but it shows us that as we move forward to these high resolution maps of the CMB, we can now take advantage of optical galaxy information and other traces. And this is an area that I think will grow a lot. We have efforts underway to continue this kind of analysis with our different fields. So I'll tell you about the status of ACT in a minute, but you know, this is something that's growing in interest. And I think for everyone who's interested in cosmological model building, the KZ effect will give us one way really to probe new physics in a way that it's kind of the new window into CMB observations. And so you should be looking and thinking about how your models will affect signatures of the KZ. Okay, so where are we now? So a couple of years ago, we presented our preliminary first season polarization results in 2014 on a few small patches, so in total around 200 square degrees. Very soon we'll be releasing our observations with a second season added to that, again sticking to our deepest region. So we'll have about 550 square degrees, which increases the area, and we've decreased our noise, which is great. We're around in noise temperature of about 10 microkelvin minute, which is very good. But we've observed much more. So we have 2,000 square degrees that we've observed in the BOSS field, so that typically, you know, preferentially overlap with Sloan observations. And that will be analyzed and kind of put out as fast as we can. And some neat things are coming. So this is all very preliminary. Yeah.
Can we prepare for the figure for the deep patches in this larger 2,000 square degree region as lower
noise or higher noise? Oh. I do that know that number, but it's fallen out of my. I want to say 17, but I'm not entirely sure. I want to tear out 17 microkelvin. And we've also observed both in the day and night, because the CMB doesn't care. But we have restricted ourselves to night observations for now, but we have all this extra day data that we need to understand. It's a little bit difficult to understand because the telescope does behave a little bit thermally, and so you need to correct for some of that. But we'll be processing all of that data. So what can we see? So these are actually some preliminary observations of a polarized source in Taurus A, which we measure in two of our detectors, which is quite neat and particularly useful because if you're looking for any interesting cosmological models that might do strange things like birefringence, that might give you interesting correlations, you want to make sure that you get your angle right, your polarization angles. And you can do it one of two ways. You can either say, well, I expect my cross correlations to be zero, say my EB or whatever, I expect it to be zero, and so I fit for the angle that makes it zero, but then you knock out all possibility of doing any interesting cosmological tests with that. So one of the things we want to do is measure polarization angles of strongly polarized sources so that we can, you know, independently calibrate our angles. And this is tough. So just to show you what the resolution of ACT is compared to Planck, this is in temperature still. But yeah. And so we have polarization measurements as well, which is pretty good. So here are our almost up to date today, but not quite up to date today, measurements of the power spectrum. And I'll walk you through some of them. So I've put them, this is again made by Arminia. You can see the top plot is very similar to the Planck one from before, the temperature constraints. And we're adding to both E and B polarization measurements. So these are the, dust plus lensing bicep Keck results. These are actually cross correlations, lensing polarization cross correlations, which is why the error bars look you know, crazily small. And at the moment, we have upper bounds on BB. And you see one of the things that's the most important is really our E-mode polarization spectrum is increased, is in precision a lot. We haven't actually cleaned out any of the foregrounds. And we don't have very many. There are only a few polarized sources, which is why some of the points on E are high at the end. But I wanted to make sure this is like as raw as you can get. We're pushing hard on improving our constraints on the lowest multipoles as well. The things we need to deal with being at, on the ground is that you get ground pickup, which in you can sort of mask out if you just whack out the lowest modes. Because we're scanning, so the telescope looks at the sky and just scans like this, just kind of straight. So in temperature, it just looks like striping in the maps. And in polarization, it can get a little bit more complicated. But we have really great map makers and people focused on this from a computational standpoint, which is fantastic. One of the things that I'm working on actually with Dottie Marsh, who was here until just recently, is looking at constraints on our axion models based on both this, but also projecting for future experiments, because it's quite exciting what you can do and what the axions will really do to the, both the lensing that we reconstruct from polarization, but also the power spectrum itself. Okay, so where are we going? I always think it's good to remind ourselves not only of the work that's going on in the CMB, but also who's doing it, because there are a lot of different groups focusing on different areas of both frequency and resolution space. So in the Atacama, of course, there we are. But there are also other experiments. So CLASS is measuring mainly large scales. Polar Bear is focusing on very small regions and going incredibly deep to try and measure B-modes that way, rather than looking at a large scale, large area. We have folks at the South Pole. Of course, we have BICEP, Keck, and SPT as well, and the Keck Array. And again, they're also pretty co-located. And focusing, again, on large scales, but also small scales with the South Pole Telescope that will provide us with independent constraints. I don't know if anyone has watched the BICEP launch from a couple of last December. It was amazing. It's successfully ran. I think it did 21 days. In orbit before coming down, but the launch itself is going to get, it will give you a heart attack. It's really amazing to watch. Spider. Yeah, it's really, really amazing. Even though I knew it, we had launched successfully, just watching the video, it's crazy. And apparently, speaking to Bart Netherfield in, at the Dunlap, they had certain kind of torque requirements on the telescope, and he thought, let me just up the torque requirements, even though it's crazy. And apparently they were pushed on the launch. They were pushed all the way to the limit because you can see there was basically swinging around wildly before they let it go. It's really amazing. There are also other experiments being built at different frequencies in other places. So Seabass, for example, is measuring much lower frequency, but it's going to provide us with a full scale map of the sky. And that's useful because if we've learned anything from the past year and a half, it's that foregrounds are important and we need to understand them. And so having different probes do complementary analyses, I think, is really useful. So in terms of ActPol, we're moving from smaller patches. So here are some of our patches where we've observed outlined with some other experiments. So there's Polar Bear, these very small patches here. There's Bicep Keck. Bicep Keck, we've measured here ActPol, the white, also on the equator. And then the BOSS fields are sort of on the sides, wrapped around. And then SPT, obviously, in the south. SPIDER will overlap with some of the BICEP Keck field, which is good. So we can check that, check all the results. But you can see there's sort of a patchwork of data all over the sky. Our efforts with advanced ActPol is to really observe much more of the sky. So hopefully push as close as we can get to 20,000 square degrees, which means we'll overlap with kind of just about everything, including LSST, which will provide, again, more cross-correlation opportunities and understandings. But I think even more than the survey area, one of the main things to understand really is the fact that we're going to have multi-frequencies. So advanced ActPol, which has been funded and is going to start operations next year, will measure the CMB in 5 bands, and then we'll supplement with the 353 gigahertz channel from Planck. So here, this is from the Planck collaboration paper where they talk about the different components. So you see the temperature model of foregrounds is much more complicated, but it's really important that we understand all of the different components because they'll have a non-negligible impact on what we can constrain. And here you see, again, here are the expected signals from contamination from foregrounds. And if we want to really get at something as small as the kinetic acid, we need to use as many frequencies to remove that based on the fact that we know that they have a specific frequency dependence. To summarize where all the experiments are in that space, this is also borrowing from a slide from Joe Dunkley, but it's taking that same plot above, which gives the Planck frequency bands, and showing where these various experiments are in frequency space. And so we're lucky to be overlapping a lot on a range of frequencies, kind of from 30 to 200, but we'll be supplemented by these different bands, and that's really useful if we're going to understand how to get at these primordial signals. This is a projection for what we think our spectrum, the error bars, will be. And so this is, again, a little bit complicated, but we have E-mode constraints, and then the BB spectrum is here, with a variety of whatever your scalar to tensor ratio is. We show a variety of models, and you see the very lowest signals are shown here by the sort of shaded out constraints.
So this is a projection for advanced.
It is, yeah.
The green one.
Basically the green is three times the foregrounds, so double, three times the foregrounds that are in the just the standard model, and the red is just the kind of raw sensitivity that we if things are optimistic. So basically you can think of optimistic and pessimistic constraints.
How long do we really know? How long do we really know the foregrounds at high polarization?
You mean, so in other words, not the sky model, just looking at the small scale stuff. I think. The SBT folks put a limit on what they think their amplitude is, and we have a very simple model at the moment. We find we have one or two very bright sources, and if we don't mask them out, we get an amplitude, and if we mask them out, we get almost nothing.
Right.
So in that sense, yeah. Until you exactly, and I think what we wanted to do when we did this proposal is that just not to be too optimistic, given that, you know. But I agree. At the moment, it looks like close to zero is okay, or at least one component. You know, just like a Poisson amplitude of polarized. It does look possible, at least on the small scales. On the larger scales, it's more complicated, but on the small scales, at least it seems okay.
And where do you think your best limit is going to? Well, I guess it only comes from less than
right. 200 or so. So yeah, so this is if we assume R of 10 to the minus 2, then we have sigma R of 3 times 10 minus 3, so pretty good constraints. So we will detect 10 to the minus 2. At 3 sigma.
That's
a good question. So we have spent a lot of time pushing down, or our estimates to push down to, you know, to low L. Obviously, that's where it's all going to be. So we have different ideas for how we'll get at that, particularly like having a half wave plate. So one of the things I suggest is that you actually get one of the ACPOL experimentalists to come and give a talk, by the way, because the physics of how this is all going to work is pretty amazing. It remains to be seen. Obviously, these are assuming that we will get down pretty low, but I'm confident that that's okay.
Is the month more important than, the peak at 1100?
Well, that's 10 times the signal voltage. If you go up
in a space.
But the signal foregrounds is
there are more modes that high L, so why does this happen? Yeah, more, you have more modes than high L.
That's it.
No, but I think
not from inflation. I mean, the gravitational waves is just the difference.
Exactly.
No, I'm not talking about that. So there's a realization bump, which is
at about
10, and then at L of 100 is just the gravitational waves, and I have more steps. So why is there step?
Right, but I mean, it's still.
So only if R is 0.2, is there a bump?
Hmm?
Right, yeah, it's
when you go
still,
to R 0.01, that's not much.
Right, the difference is still, it's much smaller. Like, so just if R is 0.2, then that's fine. Like, then the signal's bigger, and so the difference is bigger, and so it's fine. But the point is, if R is very low, if we're in this regime, then if the overall everything is low.
Now, separate lensing from? Okay, lensing, we can model it and take it out.
Right. So there is work saying, okay, can we do delensing and how will that improve constraints? And that's, that's also remains to be seen. I think this is super exciting. I mean, we'll, you know, continue to push, but.
If there were no foregrounds, then the lowest levels would have most of the signal noise. Like in the full sky, the quadrupole of the gravitational wave beam has half the signal noise, and 90% comes from that local span.
Yeah.
Does SPIDA have a similar prediction? They're going to get down to 0.01?
I think so. Yeah. I think even with their, I think their error is comparable, maybe a little bit bigger, maybe 5 times 10 to the minus 3. But yeah. So they might not have, it might be marginal if you make the worst predictions for foregrounds. But.
So where advanced acts wins is the multi frequency? Is that? What's a big advantage of
advanced? Then again, assuming the cleaning works, multi-frequency. Also, we do have not as deep, but large sky, you know, full sky, which. The other thing that we'll do, and I should wrap up, but understanding how, if you assume, okay, let's assume we're not going towards the large scales, let's look at the small scales, then this KSZ that I talked about is actually really important and comes through. So one of the things we realized is that you can use the temperature, the polarization to predict the temperature, right? We know that the polarization is sourced by the quadrupole, and so it's the same underlying physics. So you can say, given a really good E-mode map, I can predict what the T should be. Now, you can do this in two ways. You can do this at the map level, or you can just say, let me run my cosmological parameters based on the EE, and then estimate what they are, and then just predict the TT completely. And then I can remove that TT theory, which is really a constrained theory, from my data, and the only thing that's left in the TT is the foregrounds. Foregrounds and anything that's degenerate with the CMB, which in this case is the KSZ. So if you, in addition, do a really good job of constraining your foregrounds with multi-frequency, you can take away, in essence, everything except the KSZ from your temperature. And so that's what we were showing here. So the this plot is kind of neat. This is predicting advanced act EE, kind of predictions or reconstructions of what the temperature CLs will be. And the dark band is 1 sigma, and the light pink band is 30 sigma on our predicted theory temperature power spectrum using measurements from the EE. An easier way to see that is if you basically say, well, what is the delta CL, like predicted minus potential observed, divided by the error bar, and you get this kind of band. And the reason why that's important is on small scales. Because here I'm showing two realizations of different KSZ spectra from different models of reionization. And as you get to, L of 2000, 3000, the fact that those curves are well above your residual temperature means that we'll be able to detect them at very high significance. Because basically what we've done is we've used our multi-frequency to remove the point sources and the dust and all of that. And then we've predicted the theory temperature from our data polarization and removed it. So the only thing left really is the KSZ signal. And so we should be able to detect the amplitude of the KSZ signal to about 15 sigma.
Now, how about the lensing power spectrum?
So So we actually found that delensing kind of almost does nothing. It's not significantly degenerate with this.
I mean, most of the temperature power is lens like that helps because of the amplitude, lens amplitude depends on.
But that depends on sigma 8. Sigma 8, omega matter.
Small scales. These are like the scales of individual objects. It depends on like profiles of halos. Nonlinear physics, which is hard to
I hear your point, and I guess what we haven't done is assumed very different. I mean, there you'd have to kind of do a much more complicated simulation game, saying, let me simulate the halos, estimate, do ray tracing, and then get the power spectrum event, you know, for each realization. That we haven't done.
Yeah, it depends on the
variable physics. Yeah, yeah. So that we haven't done.
So potentially there's a degeneracy between basically lensing due to nonlinear halos or small halos and then
right.
KLC.
Right. Although on the very early, yeah, I mean, then at least you have just an amplitude because we expect it to be going like whatever, L to the minus 2 or whatever. So at least then you can just say there's an amplitude, you know, in that tail, there's just an amplitude of the power spectrum from lensing and I can maybe marginalize over that. Okay, so in doing this, we'll be able to constrain reionization, both when it happened and the duration of reionization. I'm well out of time, so I won't keep going. I think that was basically it anyway. Here's another photo of ACT, just in case you forget where we are. Hopefully, I got you excited for some of the things that we're doing that are individual projects but are really interesting ways of using our data. And I would encourage you, if you have models of different bias prescriptions or different ways that you think overdensities and underdensities would affect the CMB and CMB lensing, think of these observations as ways to constrain those. But also, you know, start thinking of theoretical predictions for KZ signals because the next generation will allow us to put really tight constraints on this era of physics that I think to date has been our least explored epoch. So thanks.
So when is this data going to be public?
The ad poll?
Yeah.
So we're pushing hard to get the power spectrum paper out for the first two seasons. And you're looking at the person that will then make the maps public. Being funded by NSF, there's a strong desire to publish maps at the same time, and so we will put out both polarization and temperature maps associated with this sometime after the release, but not too long after. We're already kind of getting the pages ready on Lambda and kind of getting the data ready. But that will be the deep 5.6, the larger but still deep fields. In terms of the big release of the full data set, that takes a little bit more time just to understand all the issues, because now we've, you know, a lot of our initial map making was based on small patches. It's very easy to do a lot of the approximations, and now we really have big patches of the sky. So
what is the latest ACT data which is public?
The latest ACT data that's public is was the last of our temperature maps. I don't think we've released the polarization maps from the first season because they were much smaller.
What area is that?
For the temperature data? Three or 400 square degrees. Yeah, so that's where our equatorial and our south maps, and those were observed in 2008, 9, 10 at, and we released two frequencies, 148 and 220.
But you had bigger areas even before
ACT. Yeah, actually, maybe it's something like 900. I should know that number. Something like 900 square degrees, but in different patches. I think, yeah.
So within a year.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, no, we're talking, yeah, much sooner than a year. Yeah. Yes?
Regarding the CMB weak lensing, if you add the gravitational potential part, you have such a potential back, you can calculate the lenses of gravity that's supposed to be avoided. When do you expect to get a better data to constrain this potential?
That's a good question. So I think, you know, so we are putting out a paper that will do a another reconstruction with our data. And so the lensing reconstruction favors the lensing parameter of 1. So basically the same amount of lensing that you'd expect just in normal GR. And the peak smearing is 1.2. So it's just larger with an error bar, you know, of about 0.1. So, or it's 1.4 with an error bar of 0.2. But basically, there's too much peak smearing relative to the amount of lensing we expect from the reconstruction. And it's worth mentioning that our reconstruction, again, also agrees roughly with the lensing reconstruction. Now, a caveat to that, I think, is that the Planck team, any experiment understands their temperature better because it's, you know, it's a two-point function rather than a four-point function, and I would say that the Planck team have worked really hard to understand the temperature, and there are still some systematics with the lensing. So you saw that they restricted their L range. I would say the way it will be resolved with Planck is when Planck release lensing data over the full multiple range that they trust. And if they stop failing some of their systematic null tests on the smaller scales. So I guess Kendrick is the man to ask when that'll happen. I guess a year from now, maybe, on that time scale. Then Planck will release everything, final papers of everything. And I think that will, given that it's one of the biggest remaining tensions, I think they will focus a lot on understanding that. I would say if I were a betting woman, I would, even though the number is 1, for the reconstruction, I would say that there are still more systematics in the reconstruction that they don't understand, just because they've said that themselves.
I think it'll be resolved.
And I think it's probably not going to be cosmological. I think it's going to be systematic. But that's okay. Yeah, so within a year, I'd say. Sure, but you know how much I like 2-sigma flukes, Kendrick. I made my money on 2-sigma flukes.
You said you weren't a gambling woman.
Sorry?
You said you weren't a gambling woman.
That's it, I was a gambling woman, yeah. Cool, I'll be around for the rest of the day, so please continue to talk.